Welcome to Luck is Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. On the eve of her swearing in as Portland's first Black woman city council member, Joanne Hardesty wrote to her supporters, "On Wednesday, January 2nd at 9 a.m., I will be officially sworn into office and take on the great challenge ahead at City Hall. While I have no doubt that together as a community, we will be able to accomplish great progress for our wonderful home, I ask that you continue to do what you have done best. Keep showing up and holding elected leaders, including myself, accountable, transparent, and committed to the values we hold true to our city." Today, Joanne Hardesty joins us to take a look at what is in store for the city now that there's a majority of women on the Portland City Council, and it looks like Joanne's voice is being heard loud and clear. Joanne, welcome to Luck is Focus.
Thank you, Barbara. It's my pleasure to be here.
And it's our pleasure to have you as our latest city commissioner. I've been thinking about where to start because there's been so much that happens, and there's a certain joy I feel every time I hear on the news. And Commissioner Hardesty just said, or Commissioner Hardesty has basically changed this vote. So just kind of briefly, how do you think you have changed things since you've come on city council?
Well, I think having the voice of someone who is a working class person, who's a renter, who's lived in this city for over 30 years, and who's worked passionately to make this city better, really provides a perspective that has truly been missing from City Hall and City Council deliberations.
And so I'm just thinking back, one of the articles that I read shortly after you were sworn in talked about how the city council had primarily been white men who were all landowners. Kind of sounds like the people who were the founding fathers of the United States. So what did that do as far as maybe precluding Portland from being in reality the great bastion of liberalism that it liked to pretend that it was?
Well, you know, Portland does have this very mixed perspective of itself. We love to say we're liberal, we're progressive, we're inclusive, and everybody's welcome. But as you know, our political system is set up so that normally he or she who raises the most money wins. And so what that's meant for city council has been downtown business interests have basically always picked city council leaders because those are the folks with deep pockets. Those are the ones that give $20,000 to $30,000 per campaign cycle. But of course, those were not the people who supported my campaign. So from the beginning, I knew that those would not be the people supporting me, that it would be other working class people, other runners, other people who felt like their voice was not heard at City Hall. And so it really made a huge difference, A, having three women, and all three of the women just happened to be runners. All three of the women also came in through a different process to the city council. So I think the majority of the city council now has a lived experience that's different than what we expect from people who are running and serving on the city on city council.
Now, I want to go through some of the most recent things that you've had a strong influence on in the very short time that you've been on city council and talk about the kind of shift in the voting patterns of the other council members. I think the first thing, and you might correct me and say that I'm missing some major other things, but one of the first issues that came up was whether Portland was going to withdraw from the Joint Terrorism Task Force. And I just followed listening to news reports, but I got the impression that the first vote, I'm going to just take it back. That's not the first thing. First thing was about this police officer, who made some very racist comments at a roll call. And there was going to be the city council was going to come to an agreement to basically pay him off. And it had to be unanimous in order for this agreement to go into force. And you were the single vote, if I'm correct, who opposed the payoff. Am I right there?
Well, partially. So the agenda item was on the consent agenda, which meant that it required a unanimous vote, and it was not going to have any conversation at all. So the consent agenda is something that, you know, a motion is made, and we just approve everything on the consent agenda if there's nobody who objects. I thoroughly objected, A, to the payout, and B, to not having a public conversation about both what this officer said and then how we are now in a position where we're offering him money to go away. And so I had been briefed by the city attorney on what this officer said, and I just thought that there was just under no circumstances I would vote to give him $100,000 to make him go away.
Actually, let's just mention what he said, because people, particularly we have listeners outside of the city, they might not know. Why were you so concerned about what this officer said?
Well, he was at roll call, and basically he was making a comment about what you do when you come across intoxicated people on the streets in downtown Portland. And he basically said if they're white and in a suit, just let them go because they'll probably sue you. If they're Latino, call Cheers, which is the alcohol van that comes and picks folks up. And if they're black, just shoot them. Luckily, there were a couple of sergeants at roll call who were appalled enough that they turned them in. And so they filed a complaint against him. What's interesting is that there were only a couple of officers that filed a complaint. So anyway, the chief and the mayor both decided that he should be fired. However, the discipline code basically says if someone does make some kind of inappropriate remark, the worst you could give them is a 3-week suspension with no pay. But the chief and the mayor, to their credit, thought his remarks were so egregious, he deserved to be fired. Then, of course, the union decided that they would fight him being fired. And so the attorneys, the city attorneys, negotiated this deal to make him go away. We traditionally, the city of Portland loses arbitration in police cases every single time. We've never been able to keep a police officer fired who has been fired by the chief and the police commissioner because arbitration, 99.9% of the time, sides with the police officer. And so they get their job back and they get back pay.
So why? Continue.
Oh, but I was going to say, but I felt that his conduct was so egregious that it was worth the fight. Because even if we fought and lost, we would have still had to pay him $100,000. But the thing is that we would have fought. We would have sent a strong message that said, this is absolutely not acceptable in the City of Portland Police Bureau. So I felt very strongly about that. My colleagues came to a different conclusion. They knew that if we fought, we'd probably lose. But I'm about fighting for what's right and justice. And I thought, this is worse, the $8,000 additional that it would cost us to defend our position in court.
So what was the upshot of the decision?
I'm sorry?
What was the final decision that the city council made?
The final vote was 4-1 to provide him with that settlement, with that parachute. So now he has a city retirement, and he also has an additional $100,000, and he gets to retire into the sunset and maybe go work for some other police agency in the Portland metro area.
It seemed, though, that that in a way that vote was a little surprising to me. I was surprised that a couple of the people who've sided with you on other issues went along with that vote, though they might have had, I guess, more fearful that they wouldn't have gotten rid of this police officer if they hadn't. But I'm interested in how things shifted so that you had a vote about the Portland withdrawing from the Joint Terrorism Task Force, that you had a couple allies that you didn't have the first time.
That is correct. But, that was one of the promises that I made when I ran for office, was that if Portland was really going to be a sanctuary city, we could not be cooperating with the federal government, especially this particular federal government, who seems to be really focused on immigrants and refugees and African Americans for prosecution. The fact that they have totally ignored the rise in white supremacy and white nationalist activities really made me concerned. What are they doing? And when I talked to them, when I first got in office, they assured me that they were focused on identifying and prosecuting white supremacists. But that has not been my lived experience, And that's certainly not what I see in Portland when there are protests and white supremacists show up and march in our streets.
So how did you get the support of Chloe and Amanda to pull out of the Joint Terrorism Task Force?
Well, I think that there is a perception at City Hall that all votes should be 5-0, that we should always be singing Kumbaya, and therefore, if we don't have a 5-0 vote, we should not move forward. My goal is always to try to seek a 5-0 vote, but it was clear to me from the beginning that the mayor and Commissioner Fish were very supportive of the Joint Terrorism Task Force, and did not want to withdraw. What was interesting is both the mayor and Commissioner Fish both had recommendations about how to make it better. But, you know, they could have made it better before I got there. I came in with the intention of getting us out. We had a work session so that everybody had the opportunity to ask the FBI and Portland Police directly about the impact of their work in our community. And I just believe that we had a compelling argument. We certainly had enough public testimony. We had the city council chambers absolutely packed from top to bottom. So the balconies open again. That was packed. The bottom was packed. And we had an overflow room that it was standing room only. So clearly this was something that Portlanders really cared about. And I believe Commissioner Udaly and Commissioner Fritz understood that this was very, very important to the community, and that's why they supported it.
Now, do you feel like having the fact that there's a woman majority on council might be having some inroads, too, in making some changes?
Oh, no question. No question. I think women come to policy decisions differently than men do. I was really kind of appalled listening to the FBI and the Department of Justice tell us basically to trust them, right? Well, we're the good guys. You got to trust us. And I thought, well, that's not a compelling argument. Just because somebody tells you to trust them doesn't mean you should. And as we know, the FBI has a long history of targeting groups who are working for civil rights, environmental justice, and other very progressive causes. And this FBI really gives us a pause because they certainly don't appear to be working on behalf of justice for everyone in our community.
Well, I want to just do a little thumbnail history of Portland's relationship to the Joint Terrorism Task Force, because back when it was first started, didn't Portland refuse to join?
Yes, yes. Well, in fact, after 9/11, it was Tom Potter who said, if I cannot supervise my employees because they would not give him the top secret security clearance, that the two Portland police officers who worked with the task force were able to receive, then I'm not going to have employees working in an environment that I can't supervise. And so he chose not to join the terrorism task force.
And then how long was Portland out of it? I mean, I'm trying to remember. I was actually trying to remember for myself when Portland actually joined it.
Well, if you may remember, Tom Potter said no. Sam Adams had us partially in. Charlie Hales is the one that put us back in fully. And now I'm happy to say I'm the one that got us pulled out fully once again.
It seems kind of like poetic justice. I kind of appreciate that, actually.
It really is, and quite frankly, I'm kind of appalled at some of the arguments that were made to keep us in. How could you pull us out? We're going to be safer if we're at the table. Well, there's no evidence to show that we are safer colluding with the FBI. In fact, the only cases that have been tried for terrorism in Portland were cases that were facilitated by the FBI.
Actually, sting operation, as I recall. The kid got duped into trying to set a bomb at Portland's at Pioneer Courthouse Square.
Yeah, that young man was leaving the country until the FBI provided him with an apartment and provided him with resources so that they could set him up to pretend that he was going to explode a bomb during the Christmas tree lighting ceremony. So I just think that based on their history in Portland, there's really no good reason for us to trust what the FBI tells us and what they're doing as far as who they are surveilling and what they're doing with that information.
Well, if you're just joining us, we're talking today with Joanne Hardesty, who is our latest, newest city commissioner and the first African-American woman to be on the Portland City Council. And you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. As you're talking about not trusting the way that the FBI surveils people, I remember a number of years ago, there was a bunch of files that were released when Portland had a Red Squad back in the 1970s, which was basically a squad that went after the Reds, kind of like you and me, basically. Yeah, but what really blew my mind, they had a list of all these organizations that the Red Squad had been surveilling. And one of them was this child care center, children's club that I sometimes worked for. And I thought, this is really weird that you have a child care center, you know, that's being surveilled by the FBI, and the reason being that it was run by lesbians, I think. But that I think goes to show just how much we give up when we decide to work with the FBI.
That's absolutely right. And when I asked both Mr. Cannon, who's the FBI director for Portland, and Billy Williams, who's a director with the Department of Justice, I asked both of them, do you support Portland's sanctuary law? And they both said they had no obligation to support a state law. They were required to follow federal law. And so if they say that in a public hearing, then why would we think they're not surveilling people who they believe are immigrants, refugees, and people that are advocates for Black Lives Matter?
So what difference do you think it's going to make now that you and Commissioners Fritz and Udalli have basically pulled Portland out of the Joint Terrorism Task Force? What kind of statement does that make, besides the fact that we don't have this official relationship with the FBI anymore?
Yes, I think the message that I hope sends to the public is that we're going to do what we think is right, what we think will keep community members safe, and what we think is in the best interest of Portlanders. And clearly, there's a lot of, it's interesting because just like if I have testified three times on the Portland Joint Terrorism Task Force, ironically, this is the only time I got to vote on it. But three times I have been at City Hall to say we should not join the Joint Terrorism Task Force. There's no way for us to supervise employees that are a part of the task force. And so it was wonderful this time to actually have a vote and know that my vote would make a huge difference in pulling us out.
Now, do you feel that you are a good, well, say, an influence on Commissioners Fritz and Udalli in terms of future issues that might come up?
I definitely think so. It's clear to me that we won't agree on all issues, but we certainly have enough in common and enough lived experiences in common that we're going to be able to do good stuff together.
Well, I want to talk.
A great example is the publicly funded campaign system that goes into effect in 2020. That's something that Commissioner Udalli, Commissioner Fritz, and I thoroughly support. But the men on the city council don't, because the men are used to getting elected the old-fashioned way.
No, it's kind of funny. You know, Nick Fish, who I was actually a little bit disappointed in his trajectory once he got elected, because he really ran like he was running from the grassroots, and he supported a whole lot of things that I cared about. But it seems that other interests had more influence on him, I guess, than some of the things that he professed in his first few campaigns and then his final successful campaign for city council. And I just kind of wonder where he's coming from now, because it seems that I saw the same thing with the fossil fuel infrastructure ban that city council passed 3 years ago, that he had funny questions that didn't quite jibe with a position that I would have expected from him. So I'm kind of wondering where you see him, and is there a way to have maybe an influence on him as well and maybe remind him of the roots he comes from?
Well, I certainly hope so. I mean, my goal, again, is always to get a 5-0 vote for policies that I'm trying to move forward. But I also am not compelled to wait until I can bring two other commissioners on board. I think that there's been this perception at City Hall that unless everybody agrees, and in fact, I think my first week I was told, well, Commissioner Saltzman was a reliable vote. And I said, well, Commissioner Saltzman has retired. it's a new day at City Hall, right? So, but I will always tell you whether or not I'm going to support where you're going. So you won't be surprised. I will never surprise you. But things like the police settlement, should not have been something that they had any expectation that I would have voted for.
Well, I want to talk about one other police scandal, really, in Portland. And this was reported in the Portland Mercury and in the Willamette Week, last week, I guess. And you had a very strong comment about it on your Facebook page about this Portland police officer who was in very close contact with the leader of the basically the neo-Nazis from Vancouver who come over and do these nasty demonstrations in Portland. And I wanted to talk a little bit about your sense about where that's going and what kind of direction you would want to take a lead on maybe to resolve.
Well, for people who may not know, so yes, this officer seems to have a buddy-buddy relationship with this gentleman from the Patriot Boys, and I say that very lightly, Joey Gibson organizes these very violent white nationalist marches. Doesn't live in Portland, lives in Vancouver, but comes here. And what I have observed personally has been Portland police turning their back to the white nationalists and attacking counter-protesters. And I have heard reports, I've seen videos, I've even seen with my own eyes Portland police officers in full riot gear intimidating the counter-protesters and seeming like that they're just buddy-buddy with the white nationalists that are marching. We have video of Portland police of white nationalists actually assisting Portland police officers in arresting counter-protesters. And so we've asked Portland Police Bureau and the police commissioner to investigate that in the past. Now, when these texts came to light, it became real. It didn't surprise me. Let me just say that first. It didn't surprise me at all because I had already seen enough to know that Portland police officers were, if not working in collusion, with white nationalists, certainly supportive and accommodating to them. For example, when they found the white nationalists on the rooftop the day before a big march with all these rifles in their car, they did nothing. They let them go with the rifles in the car. I find that very troubling. And so I have actually read probably about 100 texts that Officer Nia traded back and forth with Joey Gibson, and it certainly sounds like that they are trying to be buddy-buddy. What we've heard from the police bureau, of course, is, well, it's the police officer's job is to build relationships with marchers, and that is absolutely true. And so that is not something that I have a problem with. But I do have a problem with him giving logistical information to these white nationalists and then encouraging them on what to do if they have warrants out for their arrest. I'm saying, I'm not going to run your name, but if you got warrants, tell your friends that just don't bring any attention to yourself. So this is, to me, that is inappropriate, and that should be something that he's held accountable for.
So what's going to happen next with him?
Well, so here's what I asked for. I asked for an independent investigation by someone outside of Portland and certainly outside of Portland Police Bureau. I've asked maybe that they could bring in a former Seattle police chief, Stamp, or someone from the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. So we've given them a short list. We've given the mayor and Chief Outlaw a short list of organizations that we think could do an independent investigation. But I think that this is an issue that runs very deep within Portland Police Bureau, this issue of white nationalism. And if that is true, then we need to identify it and we need to get it out of the Portland Police Bureau.
Actually, this is not a problem just in Portland. I understand this is a problem in police departments throughout the country.
Well, and as you know, I mean, the police department started with an entire Ku Klux Klan membership. They went from being on the street to being police officers. So I would not be surprised. I mean, remember, we still have the Nazi that still works for Portland Police Bureau, even though his service record is clean. And so if you didn't live here, you would know that we have a Nazi officer that still is collecting a paycheck every week at the city of Portland.
So this officer, this Lieutenant Jeff Nia, has been removed from his position. Is that correct?
That is correct. He has been removed from actually providing support for protests. He is still on the job. He's just been reassigned to another job.
Now, I was just wondering, because our relatively new police chief, Outlaw, who people were very excited when she came to Portland, but it seemed like in the early standoffs between the Nazi demonstrators and counter-Nazi protesters, that she basically took a position that really upset a lot of people in the progressive community. Do you feel like
yes.
she's starting to make changes? And I'm just kind of wondering, what kind of relationship are you developing with her?
Well, I'm meeting with her on a regular basis, and I'm certainly trying to help her see the need to reform Portland Police Bureau. I think that, like a lot of police chiefs, I think she gets defensive when you challenge the actions and activities of her officer, of her officers. And so the good news is that even though I meet with her regularly and I want to maintain an open communication with her, the reality is that I'm already on a mission of changing the Portland Police Bureau without actually having being a part of the Portland Police Bureau. So, for example, because I have the rest of the public safety system in my portfolio, I'm starting to look at how do we change first responders so that we're actually only sending police to calls that are about criminal activity that's taking place or solving either preventing crime or solving criminal activity that has taken place. We need to stop sending police to calls for people who are suffering mental health issues, people who are houseless on the street. Those are not appropriate for police to go to, and they don't normally turn out well when police are part of those kind of conversations.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle, and today we're talking with Portland's newest city commissioner, Joanne Hardesty. Now, I have some friends who were kind of amazed in a way that you got elected because you were quite well known for many years for taking on the police and it probably speaking truth to a certain kind of power that wasn't used to having truth spoken to. And I wonder, I think it's interesting that you not only won your election, but you won by a really wide margin. And does that say anything to you about maybe Portland's shifting relationship with its own police department?
I think it does. I think Portlanders had a real choice in this election. They had a choice between criminalizing people who are houseless, pushing people out of the city core into a jail on the edges of town, or actually providing a much more humane approach to Portlanders who are finding it hard to find housing they can afford to live in. So I think that my election was a mandate to a different kind of leadership, which is why I feel very comfortable going in and going wherever I need to go to try to make change at the city of Portland. I think it's heartening to know that Portlanders, when given a choice between status quo and using the police as the answer to everything, chose just the opposite. And so I feel very comfortable in my position at City Hall. And so, people say, who elected you? I love to say the people of Portland elected me. 2,700 individual donors, hundreds of people who knocked on doors for over a year, every weekend. So I feel like it was the people They got galvanized, and I'm working for the people of the city of Portland.
Well, while a lot of people know you maybe the best for taking on the police for so many years, you've actually been kind of at the intersection of many issues in Portland. As I want to talk about some of the other concerns that you have and that you brought with you from being elected, and I guess one of the ones that I think about a lot is that you have been very much involved in environmental causes. And I remember back many years ago when the Coalition for a Livable Future was a viable organization, you're on the board and you're always like introducing the big fundraising events and things like that. So how do you see your role in the environmental movement and how that intersects with your role in the social justice movement here in Portland?
Well, as you know, Barbara, before I decided to take on this crazy thing like running for Portland City Council, I was very active in developing the Portland Clean Energy Fund initiative. And that was an initiative that community members developed that would tax large retail operations by increasing their business income tax by 1% and investing those dollars in climate change, workforce development, and giving opportunity to those who've been left out of the economic engine. Just like my election, this Portland Clean Energy Fund initiative won by a landslide as well. And so since I've been at the city of Portland, I've been really monitoring its implementation. In fact, this Thursday at 2 p.m. For our city council session, we will be doing the implementation language to actually solidify putting the Portland Clean Energy Fund into the city ordinance. So that's one thing that I am so proud of, because the opportunity that that will provide for communities of color is going to be pretty phenomenal.
Let's talk a bit about I wanted to talk about the role that communities of color played in that initiative, because this was not one of the initiatives that was brought by the Sierra Club and 350 PDX and stuff like that. I mean, they were involved, but how did this initiative actually get started?
No, in fact, I was having a conversation with an environmental lawyer about what could communities of color do to be proactive. Because as I was looking at this new emerging climate justice industry, what I noticed was that it was primarily white, primarily male. And when I would question it, people would say, oh, yeah, we're going to get around to women and people of color, you know, just like we hear all the time. And so I went and started talking to communities of color. At that time, I was president of the NAACP Portland branch. So I reached out to the Native American Youth and Adult Association, to Asian Pacific Islander Network of Oregon, to Verde, and asked them to become part of a steering committee where we could flesh out what a climate, environmental, and economic justice initiative would look like. Now, remember, this is the first time in the history of Oregon that communities of color have ever come together for a proactive ballot measure that we developed, that we created, that we carried. And we gave the city council the opportunity to implement it as law. They could have sent it to the voters without comment, or they could have just passed it, but the city council chose not to. And so I am so proud that these communities went, okay, fine, then we're just going to gather the signatures we need. And that's exactly what we did. We went out, and within a matter of 5 weeks, we collected 35,000 signatures to put this on the Portland ballot. All that time, we were out talking to communities about why this measure was so important, who it would benefit, who would pay for it, and why this was necessary. So when we were doing this measure, we thought it would bring in somewhere between $35 and $40 million annually. Since I've been at City Hall, I find out that it will bring in right around $80 million annually. So this is going to be a huge investment in climate, environmental, and employment opportunities, prioritizing those left out of the economic engine. I mean, I don't think I've ever seen a ballot measure in Oregon where people of color developed it. They collected the signatures. They got it passed by the voters, and now they will be the beneficiaries of this. And so part of my job at City Hall is to make sure that, A, that money is spent as intended, and, two, that the people who are supposed to benefit really do benefit from this measure.
Now, there is a concern with every initiative that passes, whether it's actually a city council-passed initiative or a voter initiative, that when it's being implemented, things can go wrong. And that was a big concern with the fossil fuel infrastructure ban. And it took a lot of grassroots energy to keep that measure on track and to have it really have teeth. Do you have similar concerns with this, or do you think that partly because you're on city council now, that it maybe has a much clearer path of just being implemented the way it was intended?
Well, I'm certainly keeping my eye on it. I have staff who attend meetings. Anytime there's a City Hall meeting about the Portland Clean Energy Fund, I make sure that I have staff people there, so I'm getting regular report backs. You know, there's always a concern when there's new money coming into the city. Other people are always trying to figure out how they can get their grubby hands on it. But as long as I'm there and I've got a breath in me, I will make sure that those who are supposed to benefit do.
Now, I'm wondering, as you're working on implementing this initiative, what are your thoughts about the statewide clean energy jobs bill that's going before the state legislature now?
Well, my thoughts are, I hope it passed. I mean, you know, we've been trying to pass a clean energy bill at the state for quite some time. We now have a supermajority of Democrats that are supposed to make it easier to get good progressive policy through Salem. But, you know, let's hope that they're successful this year. This has been a 20-plus year effort, so I'm not confident that it will make it through the process. But if it does, that will be good. The good news is if that one passes, then the businesses who are paying the Portland Clean Energy Fund initiative will reduce that tax from the tax they have to pay at the state level. So even though they will pretend that they're being double taxed, they won't be.
Well, one of the things that I'm concerned about is seeing the knives being sharpened in the part of the business community and the fossil fuel interests here in Oregon. And I just wonder if from all the failures we've had in the past and the big failure in Washington State with their initiative, the clean energy initiative that went down drastically last November, what lessons do you think we've learned that maybe can be put into practice to make sure that this time this initiative does get passed in Oregon?
Well, I mean, I can tell you from our experience here in Portland, when you have conversations directly with the people that are most impacted by it first, and you build the support, the community support for it, the negative stuff that the other side will put out has a less of an impact. The Portland Clean Energy Fund, we were sued right away. They tried to say it wasn't legal, we couldn't do it, and the court sided with us. In fact, we were in court for a very long time. In fact, we were concerned we wouldn't have enough time to collect the signatures that we needed to collect because the Portland Business Alliance is really effective at trying to drag these things out in court as long as possible. But luckily, the good news for us is that because they did all that at the front end, by the time we passed it, we knew it was legal, it was sound, and we could move forward with it. I hope the state learned some lessons from what we did because it is very easy for the fossil fuel industry to put a bucket load of money in and provide misinformation to the public to make sure that it goes down in defeat. And we saw that very clearly in in Washington State. It was heartbreaking to see what happened in Washington, because you knew what the public was being told simply wasn't true.
Well, you said to me, I think before the election, or maybe it was right after you got elected, that I asked you if you're going to continue your show here on KABU, Voices from the Edge, and you said, yeah, you're going to come back and do Voices from the Edge of City Hall. So first of all, are you back on the air here on KABU?
I am. I am back. I'm there on Thursday mornings, my regular spot, 8 to 9.
Have you renamed the show, or is it still Voices from the Edge?
I have not renamed it yet, but I'm still thinking about it.
Well, actually, in honor of you, this show's title, because I name each of my shows every week, this is called Voices from the Edges of City Call. So we're getting you started there.
Very cool. And, very cool. I think I don't want to limit myself on KABU to just City Hall, right?
Right.
So I might use that tag every once in a while, but I don't want to limit myself.
But when we talk on the show, whenever you come on the show, that's what we'll call it. So
excellent.
Now I want to get back to this email that I got from you right after you were elected, where you talked about the importance of your supporters continuing to show up and holding elected leaders, and you say, including yourself, accountable. So there's two parts to this. First of all, what do we need to keep everybody else accountable, and what should we do to keep you accountable?
Well, I mean, I think you have to hold me accountable to my word. If I tell you I'm going to do something, then you need to make sure that I do what I tell you I'm going to do. And quite frankly, I think the other thing is that we try to make City Hall as complicated as possible. One of the things I will do, as I promised, is to hold quarterly meetings out in the local communities. And my staff is starting to schedule those meetings now. Because, again, my hope is to get City Hall outside of City Hall into the neighborhoods in the evening where people are off work, out of school, and they can participate. Wednesdays at 9:30 a.m. doesn't work for most people. It only works for people who already live downtown or who have a vested interest in the outcomes of City Hall. We need to do a better job of getting City Hall out of downtown Portland and into the neighborhoods. So that's one thing that people should hold me accountable to, and they should be encouraging my other colleagues to do as well. There seems to be an aversion to actually talking to the people who are being represented at City Hall, and I don't understand that. In fact, one of the first things I did was ask if we could open a balcony again, because, you know, I want people to be able to come to City Hall and be able to be inside and observing us making decisions on their behalf.
Actually, I wasn't aware that the balcony had been closed, because I haven't been to any hearings, I have to admit, in a couple of years. But around the fossil fuel infrastructure hearings, that balcony was open and people were hanging banners from it. So why was the balcony closed?
Well, it was closed shortly after Mayor Wheeler took office, because there were people that were coming and being disruptive to the meetings. I think he got some of the brunt of the frustration left over from the Charlie Hales administration when he first took office. But I was actually surprised myself to find out that as a part of just regular business, the balcony was closed. And then I asked, I said, well, can I have it open? Because I expect a lot of people are going to want to come and see me get sworn in. And it would be great if we could actually open the balcony. And so I've noticed in the last 6 weeks that I've been here, the balcony continues to be open, but they don't allow people to sit in the first row. I think there's fear that people will throw things from the balcony, but I've not had that experience.
Well, actually, I mean, I think of it as being the great place to hang your banners. And in fact, some things that became very mainstream ultimately, like the fossil fuel infrastructure ban, started out as being insurgent activities from the balcony. So it seems like it's kind of a mixed
bag.
Right.
Well, I mean, I think that's what City Hall is for, right? City Hall has a responsibility to hear from the public. And, you know, as long as you're not like yelling and cursing and screaming at folks, I think any kind of civil disobedience is appropriate at City Hall.
Well, it's good to hear from a city commissioner.
I know, right? Well, this is someone who spent 25 years on the outside advocating at City Hall. So I certainly understand the importance of an organized effort to convince your elected leaders to do the right thing.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. And today we're talking with Portland's newest city commissioner, Joanne Hardesty. Now, another issue that's been coming up, the City Club did a report that just last week about changing our form of city government. And I wonder what your thoughts are about that. But the two issues are having district elected commissioners as opposed to citywide commissioners. And the other one being changing from a commission-style government to, a different one. One that they were talking about is city manager with basically a powerless mayor. So I'm wondering, do you think that those are necessary changes, or would that help democracy, or do you think that we are good with the way we are doing things right now?
I think that we have an opportunity. I think we must reform our form of government. I think we are the only major city with this form of government still in place. And just because we like to keep Portland weird is no reason why we can't move into the 21st century. But I think I have not decided on what that should look like yet. I think it's up to the people to decide what that looks like. And it's my hope that the City Club report does such a good job of raising the issue that by the time we are doing our charter review, which we will do, the City of Portland has a charter review commission that we will install in 2021, right after the census. And that is the time and the place, I believe, for a very deliberate conversation on the form of government that Portlanders want. And we can have that conversation all over the city. Because the Charter Review Commissioners, once they make a decision by an affirmative vote, it goes directly to voters. So City Council has no ability to change it, modify it, or anything.
So what do you think about having district-wide elections as opposed to citywide elections?
Well, I know that would be a lot cheaper. And I think that that's one piece of it. Just like the public finance system will go into place in 2020, a district election may make it easier. I can tell you that for the as the only city commissioner that lives east of 82nd Avenue, I can tell you that East Portland was not getting its fair share of city resources. And that continues to be a fight because most of the folks on City Hall don't have that lived experience in East Portland. When we talk about the lack of sidewalks, the lack of infrastructure, the lack of a town center, we don't get really affirmative responses from the city council. That's going to be different now that I'm on the city council because I will ask that question in all the meetings I'm in. Well, how does this impact East Portland? Well, what's going to be the outcome for the residents of East Portland?
You know, it's interesting. The last time there was a commissioner from east of 82nd Street, I believe it was Bob Koch back in the 80s, and he unseated Margaret Strom, who was a very liberal member, and he was very, very conservative. And in those days, I think that east of 82nd Street was a very different set of demographics than it is now. But
absolutely.
But I think that it does show, I think now if you had a district that was east of 82nd, it would probably they would elect you, is my theory. Though it would be an interesting mix, actually, because I think there still is a lot of conservatism out. You know, you get out past 140th Street just before you get to Gresham. But I think that, I mean, at the time, because that was shortly, it was a bit after San Francisco went from doing citywide elections to district elections. And interestingly, the first election they had for city, whatever they called it, for the Board of Supervisors, after they made the change, elected Harvey Milk from the Castro District and Dan White from South San Francisco. And that's one thought about you might get a much more polarized city council than what we have right now.
What I'll tell you is that districts does not equate necessarily to more people of color or more women getting elected and serving in public office. I can tell you as a former legislator, my district was 95% non-African American, and I got elected to the legislature because I just worked harder than my opponent. I believe that that is also true for why I just got elected to the city council, because I worked very, very hard to let people know why I thought I was the best candidate for the seat. I think if you've got the work ethic, it really doesn't matter what the demographics are. At some point, if you work hard enough, you will win the seat that you're after. But I think most people who run are totally unaware of what it takes to run for public office. And then once they win, no idea of what it takes to actually be effective as an elected official.
Well, I want to talk about a couple other issues before we're out of time that are really pressing on the city. And one is houselessness and an issue that may be actually destroying Ted Wheeler's political career. And the other one has to do with with public transit and making that affordable, if not free. So first, let's talk about, do you see a way of moving forward with the whole houseless crisis that we have here in Portland?
Well, I certainly hope so, because we are putting a lot of money into housing at this point. And then are we getting the results that we should be getting? I mean, I think some good things happened in the November election. The Metro Housing Bond passed, which provides additional resources for housing. My big fear right now is that people keep throwing around this term affordable housing as if it's a one-size-fit-all strategy. And what I am trying to encourage people to do is to talk about housing people can afford to live in. Because the median family income for a family of four in the city of Portland today, in the Portland metro area, is $72,500. So when we talk about affordable housing at 80% of the median family income, we're really talking about somebody making $50,000 a year. Well, most people aren't making $50,000 a year. So what we have is a huge gap in housing that people can afford to live in. And we have to do things differently. We've got to be much more creative in how we find permanent housing for people. We need more shared housing opportunities, more multi-generational housing opportunities, more housing that has shared space so that people may live in individual apartments, but maybe they come together to share meals or community centers or things of that sort. It feels like we are building housing like we've always built it, and somehow we're shocked that people can't afford to live in.
Well, it seems like it's really basically just market-driven right now and profit-driven. And I look at throughout the – there's two things that really strike me as I'm looking at all the housing that's going up in Portland right now. It's all the same ugly, uncreative, and I can't imagine people really wanting to live in these kind of spaces, these boxes. And then the other part of it is they seem to be really expensive. I mean, there seems, from what I can see, very little dedicated, truly affordable housing that's going in because the developers, and this is, I think, the legacy of Charlie Hales, they basically have control over what kind of housing is getting built in Portland.
Well, and let me say that today, even if we issued not one more permit for housing, there are already a five-year supply of permits on the street for people to build whatever, right? Which means that these luxury apartments that no one can afford to live in are the ones that will continue to be built. We do have some housing that is housing with support services for the very, very low income, 30% of median income and below. We have some of that housing coming on to online, but nowhere near what we need. And so I think that we have to, it doesn't feel like we're acting as if this is an emergency. We're now 5 years into the housing emergency. And it feels like we have more people living on the street today than we did 5 years ago.
Well, while we're on emergencies, I kind of wanted to go national for a moment and talk about Trump's national emergency and remind people that there is, in fact, going to be a demonstration today at Waterfront Park at 4 o'clock to protest this quasi-national emergency. But I wonder how that affects your work as a city commissioner here in Portland.
Well, I think what's become very clear is that we should have no expectation that the federal government is going to be of assistance to us. At least as long as this administration is in office, we can rest assured that anything that we have to take care of our own. And so we cannot depend on federal resources coming in to help us out of this crisis. And in fact, we should just pretend the federal government doesn't exist because it really doesn't for the folks who are suffering in our community.
So maybe we'll see you at 4 o'clock in Waterfront Park. Good way to spring. I guess they're calling it not my President's Day rally.
Yeah, well, he's never been my president.
Right.
The good news is that this too shall pass, right? We've had crazy people in office before, and it doesn't last. But my big fear is that it will take an entire generation to undo the harm he's done.
Yeah, but I guess it really helps to have people like you in office. And I guess there is kind of a wave. There have been a lot of activists who've gotten elected from everything from local government all the way to the federal government.
You know, I think that's what's exciting. I think that there are people who are no longer sitting on the sideline. I mean, I know for me, it was anger that motivated me to run for the city council because I just thought, you know, I know we can do better than what we're doing. And this has been multiplied over and over again, both in the state but also on the national level. And so that's what gives me hope. I believe that if this trend continues, by 2020, we will have some phenomenal candidates that will be running for president. I don't have a pick yet because it's way too early. I think we'll have fabulous candidates that will be running for president. And I think we have a new wave of people, as you say, who have activist backgrounds, who have been on the front lines for a long time, who finally decided, look, I'm not going to wait for the party machinery, because the party machinery is never going to support activists running for public office. And so we're just going to do it. And how wonderful that people are being successful all over the country with that mindset.
Well, we are so happy that you were successful and that you're there. And I'm hoping, Joanne, actually, that maybe we can do this as kind of a regular thing every 6 months or so, do a check-in from the edges of City Hall.
I love it. I love it. I think that would be fabulous. Yeah, because it's hard for me to interview myself on my own show.
Right. We'll give you the opportunity. And maybe next time we'll get our schedule coordinated a little better, and so you'll be sitting right opposite me as opposed to being on the phone.
I look forward to that. Yes, I would have been there, but I was told not blessed through the phone. So
I know.
Here I am.
A few confused signals this morning, but it's worked out great. So thanks so much for joining us, Joanne.
Absolutely my pleasure. I look forward to our next conversation.
Okay. Great. Today we've been talking with Portland's newest city commissioner, Joanne Hardesty, and you've been listening to Locus Focus Special Edition here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. Next week, we'll talk about Jordan Cove with Kayla Farrell Smith, a Klamath artist and activist. My engineer is Patsy Kullberg. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with a Sam Cooke tune by the Neville Brothers. Thanks for listening.
I was born by the river in a little tent. Oh, and just like the river I've been running ever since.